Hello, pals o' mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. On your list of career choices, was comedian ever on it? Yeah, mine neither. Too much pressure. I mean, it's one thing to be an entertaining smartass with your friends, and another being paid to be funny on cue. There are a number of reasons some people do choose comedian for a career. For one, it feels great to make people laugh. Another is that it's a way to move through emotional and/or physical pain. Pain is often a common denominator between comedians and their audiences, which is why many are successful, because audiences relate to what they're saying. So how do you take pain and convert it into a form of humorous expression? Navy veteran comic Jason Mack shares his story.
My grandfather, Oliver Bibby, was in the Navy for 10 years, but he had huge tattoos. And he was in the late 20s. So my grandfather had this large ship on his chest, so he'd flex, the muscles, so it looks like it was rocking on the waves. And then he had a second one on his arm muscle that was a hula dancer. Same thing, flex the muscles. And so did you get any tattoos?
No
No, you
tattoos.
ended
No.
up.
I've never seen anything that I was like, yeah, I want that on me forever. I guess I have commitment issues, maybe.
I do too. I get that.
If I was to get something, it might be like the Led Zeppelin has like four symbols, like for each band member. I've always thought those are really cool. But then, where do you put it? Some people get it like on their back, but then you can't even see it. So what's the point of that? Put it on your shoulder, and I don't know, man.
Well, with my grandfather, it was a visit down to Tijuana on leave, so.
Yeah, I had a couple of those, but just never ended up at a tattoo shop. So, worse places. There are worse places.
And safer, a little
Yeah,
healthier.
maybe.
Now, how long were you in the Navy?
4.5 years.
And when?
That was beginning of 05 to summer of 09.
And what was your impetus for signing up?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. So it was like go to college, study who knows what. I wasn't doing very well in school. I was kind of burnt out from it. Turns out I had the ADD. So apparently there's like a slight statistical bend for people with the ADD to go to the military because they want that changing work environment type of thing, the excitement and the not going to school part.
But that does make sense.
Yeah, I wanted to serve. Didn't want to go to school at that time, wanted to see some places, didn't have money, wanted money for college eventually. It all made sense.
How did you settle on that particular military branch?
A recruiter came by my house. Like I was thinking about joining the
Wow, like
Marines.
Avon, it came to you.
Yeah, it was so like 9/11 happened, and then I was like, angry little white kid in my room watching Fox News or whatever. I'm like, ah, I'm gonna, I joke around, I wanted to kill terrorists, kinda. So when the Navy recruiter came by, I was like, oh, that's perfect, because I figured my skill set was more in the technical field. So that's kind of what I ended up doing.
And what skills were those?
Google?
That's a skill.
No. No, just, I don't know,
I
just
should put
always,
that on my CV. I didn't know that
yeah.
was a skill set.
Just always had good analytic skills and computer skills, stuff like that.
How did you use them in the Navy?
I was a CTT, so cryptologic technician technical. So technical is in parentheses. So I was a technical technician, and I ended up.
That sounds so American.
I got orders for air crew when I was going through my training, and so I ended up doing that on a plane. So basically, I basically dealt with other countries' radar systems, like detecting them, using all the equipment to, deduce what they were and report them. Yeah.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was actually really cool. I really liked doing that. It just got my brain firing in the right way, and I ended up being great at that aspect of the job anyway.
Now you served in Iraq for a while.
I was in Qatar, but we were flying in that war, so our tracks are classified.
Damn.
Yeah, so that was the war we were flying in, but we were generally. The plane I was on was the EP3, so it was a modified P3 for electronic surveillance. Basically, our what's it called? The way we stay out of harm's way is just flying high and far away from any threats because we can't. There's no countermeasures. It's just a big, dumb, slow plane. So if anybody goes after us, they're just gonna get us. So That's our defense mechanism, is just staying away from stuff.
They were doing that in Vietnam. I spoke to somebody who said that he knew and had heard of pilots, helicopter pilots, that were used specifically knowing that they were going to be shot down, that they needed some light to be shown down to the jungles. Oh, and man. So, yeah, you see where that
went. That's dark.
That's, yeah, on all sides.
I love it.
On all levels, that is dark. Yeah, it's pretty vicious. Have you talked to older veterans that did something similar, but maybe a war or two ago, and kind of compared?
You know what? This is a weird thing. My last name's Mac, and I ran into a guy at my gym, because I have like a, for my pain, I have like a routine, a hot tub and then swim. And there's this this guy was talking to me about his injuries and his like mental health stuff, and he's trying to refer to me to like a psychologist or something. And he was a World War II bombardier on I think it was B-25s or something like that. He was air crew, and he crashed, got his jaw and head broken and stuff, and he had all these like hit, you know, a bunch of surgeries from that. And as he's leaving, he gives me this guy's information and says, "Tell him Mac sent you." So this dude, he's like 90, and his name was Mac also, and he was an air crew veteran. It was the weirdest
nice.
Thing. Yeah. So yeah, not a lot of, I mean, it's a really kind of a narrow field for what I do. Like in the Navy, there will only be like, you know, 15 to 30 people doing my exact job at a time. So, but no, I haven't really met, you know, maybe some similar linguists and stuff like that who do kind of a different, you know, different branch of the job.
Well, sometimes it's just easier to see where we've been, kind of how, you know, previous vets, what they had to deal with, and
yeah,
makes you appreciate even more what they faced.
For sure.
So did you set out of being in the Navy for a specific limit of time, or did you just...
Yeah, I had a four-year contract. The reason I did 4.5 years was because I extended for an extra deployment. But yeah, it was supposed to be 4 years and then go to college, but you know, didn't match up with school. So I was like, I'll go to war one more time and see how it goes, I guess.
Into the brink, as they say.
Yeah.
So you come home in 2009. You're back in the States. I assume you went and had a night in the town or two?
Yeah, one.
Just one?
Yeah, just one. It wasn't even really a night out of town. It was literally like, you know, I wanted to go eat, and I ended up having like three drinks or something like that, and it was like a sports bar that was walking distance, sometimes stumbling distance, but which it ended up being. But I got assaulted. Yeah, some dudes mugged me. I don't know them.
Just because you're there.
I guess. I mean, they took my wallet. My wallet got returned to me months later with just the $20 missing out of it. So that's what they got out of it. One of them had a rock, so he hit me with that. So that hurt. Yeah, so my jaw got fractured in two places, and that started a bunch of stuff.
So it was 7 years ago.
Yep.
And you've been dealing with medical issues since then.
Yep. That's the truth.
And what are you currently dealing with?
I'm probably going to be officially diagnosed with fibromyalgia. For about the last 5 years, it's been like a loose, like chronic pain. I've been treated for chronic pain, but a lot of times at the VA, they don't necessarily write down what you're diagnosed with, which is I don't know if that's just to keep you from getting, you know, benefits down the line. Basically, I've been told I have chronic pain. It's not...
Because you didn't know that you had pain.
Well, I knew, yeah. Well, I mean, because chronic pain, a lot of people don't know this. It's its own disease. It has its own unique pathology. So it changes the way that your body interprets pain and stressors, and it comes with all these other symptoms. It can look like it's depression or it's anxiety, or it can have those, or now you can't sleep. So it can be tricky. So it's not just the doctor's fault. It's a thing that Western medicine is really struggling with overall. But that's kind of, I think that's the best way to describe it. Chronic pain, headaches, muscle tension, anxiety that comes with that, fatigue, stress. I'll get moody and irritable when I'm in pain. I'll stop eating. I'll forget to eat because I'm in pain. I'm just in like this anxious like space. I can't relax and sit down and like, you know, enjoy a movie and stuff like that.
Yeah, being a vet, presumably you've been going through the VA.
Yep.
How's that working for you?
It's garbage. That's the best way I can... That's the nicest way I can put it. Is this a swearing podcast?
You betcha.
Oh, shit. I feel like the VA has made me worse. I would have been better just trying to figure it out on my own than getting meds, trying meds for, 6 months or whatever. Because you take doctors at their word. They treat you for a symptom and you take them at their word. It takes, I think, about 7 years to learn what you need to, what kind of advice to take from them, when to turn drugs down or when not to. I've been on 3 or 4 medications at a time, and then they've called me drug averse for not wanting to take another medication. So I've never been an anti, don't take drugs, or, I'm not a, homeopathy person or a witch, as I call them. Never been in any of that kind of stuff, but I mean, I've learned over time that that stuff has just as much value, if not more, than
because drugs. Some of the natural elements, your body just absorbs them easier. You don't have all the adverse effects that chemicals can. So some of it does help, and I think that's why it's growing and popular, because even outside the VA system, doctors are just automatically handing out meds because they're with a HMO who says you have to see 9 patients an hour, and so they would rather just write out a prescription than actually spend any in-depth time with you. But you've got the VA on top of that.
Yeah, and then chronic pain, just by the nature of it, it doesn't owe itself to, I understand what's going on. It's like you come in and they say, what's wrong? It's like, I have pain. It's like, where? Well, it's everywhere. It's like, well, where's the worst pain? Oh, my jaw, where it got fractured. So now they want to treat that. But it's like, no, my whole body is in pain. We need to treat my whole body. But what they're going to do is give you something for your jaw, write a referral to the dental maxillofacial clinic, and then they're going to fit you for a mouth device, and then they're going to lose it.
Oh, jeez.
Which happened to me 3 or 4 times. And this is all...
3 or 4 times?
Yeah.
Once, okay. Maybe.
Yeah, the dental clinic at the San Francisco VA has been just garbage for me. So they fitted me with the wrong type, and then they fitted me with the wrong, you either get top or bottom for the type that they gave me. They gave me the top when it was supposed to be the bottom, and then it turns out that was the wrong one anyway. So they fit me for one with the a plaster that they had to set, and then they lost that one, and then the next one didn't quite set right, and then they did it again, and I never heard back from them. So yeah, it's a lot of different factors that go into screwing up someone's life that bad, I guess. I don't know.
And the paperwork, just that alone, must have been hell.
Yeah.
I guess I should make it current.
It's not too bad for me because they don't really document things very well. I don't know. I don't have to do a lot. The paperwork.
Do you feel like Charlie Brown sometimes? Nobody knows that you're not at the party?
Yeah. I say when, just this last fall, I got a new doctor because I moved from the Bay Area to Sacramento, and I got a new doctor at the Sacramento VA, which is its whole other involved situation to transfer your services. Even though it's the same healthcare system, you think it'd be pretty easy. It's not that easy. I met with my new doctor, and she asked me when my back was broken. And I was like, what are you talking about? Because nobody told me that my back had been broken at some point. So they did x-rays, found the fracture, didn't tell me. And I mean, it kind of explains some of my symptoms a few years ago, mostly the back pain. But, we get x-rays and then they don't tell you anything and you figure, I'm okay, right? Or I'm, or you think it's in my head, or you go, what's wrong with me? You go into the ER and they're like, well, we don't know what's wrong with you. It's like, you come back if you get worse. So there's a discouraged care. They have statistics for people who are seeking employment, but that they're unemployed, but they're not counted in unemployment statistics because they haven't applied for work recently because they're discouraged. There needs to be a statistic for that for veterans in the VA, because at a certain point you just stop trying because They cancel appointments on you. They schedule appointments and don't tell you. They tell you then after you wait months to see somebody, they tell you they don't know what's wrong with you. So you just give up after a while and start seeing witches. No, I'm totally, like, I've done acupuncture and I'm not convinced that it's not witchcraft, but that's okay because it works.
Well, I think that it's just one of those options that helps some people, not everybody. One size doesn't fit all, just like the medical community can't help everybody either. So I think that some people, you get to a certain point, like where you are, you know, I'm just going to try anything. Somebody's got to help me with this damn thing. I'm done.
Yeah.
But ironically, you decided, even after all this pain and these screw-ups, to go into comedy.
Oh, yeah. I think it was
because,
more...
really, why wouldn't you?
I think I decided on that even before it was like a long-term issue. I mean, I knew my life was shitty when I started doing it. Comedy was really a matter of, it was like a thing that I wanted to do for a while. I always loved making people laugh. I always knew I had something firing differently. There was something there that would work, like talent-wise, in comedy. Which is a funny thing to think and say, because when you start out, you're so awful. there's something like delusional about starting comedy and being so bad for so long, but you have to keep going, like, oh yeah, there's something there, you know? I don't even know if I was even seeing doctors at the VA yet at that point, because I kind of like stayed away from it. I knew that I was spending too much time in bed and my jaw was still hurting, and it was literally like the snowball effect of you're tired all the time, so you lay down, it makes your jaw worse, it makes your pain worse, it makes you more tired, you know, now you're depressed, now you're not eating, now you have to eat something so you binge eat, now you're a college student with depression so you're drinking. So comedy was a natural fit, I guess, for me at that time.
And what are the topics that you cover besides the obvious ones?
What are the obvious ones? I talk about the VA quite a bit. That's kind of not early on, but maybe after 6 months or a year, started talking about some Navy and VA stuff. And then there was a certain time where I was too close to it, and it was affecting me to think about it all and try to process it comedically. Like, you're not, there's a point where you're not ready. There's that cliche that comedy is a tragedy plus time or whatever. There's something to that. For the longest time, I couldn't talk about my event, like getting assaulted, getting the shit beat out of me, probably knocked unconscious, and having my jaw broken in two places. And I'd keep trying to do it, and then every time I do it, I'd just be like cringing, like, oh, this is upsetting to talk about it. That's post-traumatic stress. That's, even if it's not technically post-traumatic stress, it's shit that you haven't dealt with, you're not through, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna make some jokes about this. You're just not ready for it. So yeah, I talk about the VA now. I do some amount of observational stuff, some amount of like absurd stuff. I do stuff about my puppy being a Holocaust denier.
Damn puppy.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing I do in there, is I say, like, what can you do about it? Like, I can't hit her. She's not a kid, you know, so.
Ooh, I bet you get a lot of that. Ooh.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, it's funny because that bit, I talk about my puppy. And the joke is that I talk about how when I'm in really bad, I have really bad pain and anxiety, and I'll bury my head in my hands. And my puppy will see this, and she'll come run up, she'll jump in my lap and, like, lick my face, like, push my face up with her head and, like, lick all over my face. That's the best thing about her, but the worst thing is she's a Holocaust denier. There's like that joke, like, resets the room, because I'll notice a point where the audience is like, this is fucking dark. You know, it's like they're laughing, they're having a good time, but after a certain amount of jokes about your shitty life and all the drugs that the VA is giving you and depression or whatever, they're like, come on, dude, like, give us something. And it's like, hey, I got a puppy. And like, it just resets people emotionally. Unfortunately, I can't not go to a dark place with it. So, yeah, talking about my puppy. Man, I don't know. What else? I talk about Mexican food. I like Mexican food. It's really what I can make funny at the time, I guess.
Of course, CK. Louis CK.
Yeah.
His is predominantly dark.
Yeah, yeah. That's got to be one of my, I don't know, I don't want to say heroes, but, I mean, it's, you can't not watch him and just be marveled at the craft and how he is able to make really dark stuff like palatable and like relate, like really crazy unique situations relatable, and do super dark stuff and get like a, you know, like a, it's still silly. There's like silliness to it. Yeah.
I noticed on one of your blogs you talked about open mic night, one particular one that didn't end so well.
Ooh, which one? What?
The one you wrote about.
I don't know. There's more than one, but. I mean, that's so.
Apparently you were.
They mostly don't.
Because of the darkness, or?
I don't know. Can you refresh me a little bit?
Cause it says something about, I don't have it in front of me, so.
The one that I'm thinking of happened on Monday. I was forcibly removed from an open mic.
Forcibly?
Forcibly. The bartender grabbed me and took the mic from me and pulled me off the stage.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I know.
What the hell did you say? You have to share with the class.
Okay,
yeah.
I will. So, it's... Here's the thing that I don't like about talking about this situation. The bit is about child porn. It's about being a kid and looking at child porn because you want to see girls your age. And where the bit is going to go, I wasn't allowed to on Monday, but it goes to a place about how when you're that age, you don't know about exploitation. You don't know where the pictures are coming from. You don't know what the scenarios are in here. You start to kind of get little clues that, oh, this isn't like, these aren't kids my age, you know, sharing pictures and stuff like this. It's like 40, 50-year-old dudes who want to rape little girls. So the problem, especially it's a really delicate subject, and I know it's going to turn audiences off. But it's also, I've done it on stage like 4 or 5 times. I don't know the beats of where it's funny, how far I can go, and, you know, trying to be somewhat tasteful, you know, about this, but also talk about stuff that happened. Here's a crazy thing about me getting thrown off of this stage. The guy who went up before me called the audience faggots and retards, and then said, oh, you guys don't like that word? And he said, autistic or something. Like, he just kept, like, he was basically being offensive for no comedic value, and he had this anti-PC point of view that he thought for him that was funny or that was important, whatever it was.
But Don Rickles did it better than anybody.
Yeah,
and only he
yeah.
could do it.
But no, it wasn't funny. There weren't
That's
jokes.
What I'm saying. People that try to
yeah.
be funny with that don't
yeah.
know how to do
I
it.
I mean, Don Rickles wouldn't go on stage and say, hey, you bunch of faggots.
No. Well,
what, you don't
he
like,
might.
Well, you don't like that word? Fucking retards. You know? That's not a great Rickles. But but yeah, Don Rickles would do it better. And I would do it better if I was trying to, you know, do that.
So this guy already had the crowd riled up.
They were just not happy.
Yeah.
Because... And it was a good crowd.
What
a good
great
crowd.
Setup for you.
Yeah, so I went up and I'd had a few drinks in me and I was feeling a little saucy. I might have had some anger issues I was working through. Yeah. And I spent like 2 or 3 minutes ripping into him and just kind of making fun of him for just not being funny and for, you know, yelling at the audience but not having any jokes or whatever and saying stuff like, you know, just like doing him, being like, oh, you bunch of faggots. Why aren't you laughing at me? Why don't you love me, you fucking retards? Just stuff like that. Just yelling that kind of stuff. So the crowd, like, I was killing. They were really into it because the guy was awful. So then I figured this is what I've learned about this new bit that I'm working on. I can't open with it. When I'm doing new stuff, I like to open with it so I remember to do it, first of all, and second, so I can get an honest response out of it. This bit, you can't just go up there and be like, I used to look at child porn. That turns people off immediately. So I've established that I'm funny and that they all like me and everything. And I say that, I used to look at child porn, but like it was when I was a child. There's like the, you know, people are like, what? And then you say that second part and there's, you know, there's a laugh in there. People understand now the point of view in there. Bartender threw a receipt at me and I didn't think much of it. It's an open mic, whatever. So I go in and the next thing I'm saying is that, like, here's the thing, I was like 12. You know, I didn't know there was this whole, like, system going on. That's the last thing I remember saying, because the bartender grabbed me, pulled me off the stage, pulled the mic out of my hand, and he was like trying to like push me and throw me out the door. But once I figured out what was going on, I stopped letting him move me. And he said, like, I don't find anything funny about kiddie porn. That's what he said. Which leads me to believe that he takes his kiddie porn very seriously. And then he went back to the bar. I'm, like, standing in the middle of the room. And I said, thank you, guys. I'm Jason Mack. Have a good night. I got my backpack and I went outside. And, some people told me I should go back in. I should yell at this guy. I should get back on stage or whatever. But, a friend of mine runs the room. I'm not going to ruin it for him and for all the other comics. And it's also like, it's clearly this dude's got some issues.
And you've already lost the momentum that you were working with.
Yeah. I mean, the show did too. After that, it was not the same. It was like,
it's too bad.
Yeah. It was, everybody was having a good time.
I remember being an open mic, and this is kid, like college age. And most of us were just not laughing at his jokes. Mm-hmm. And when it ended, he came walking over to us and he's like, I don't get it. All my friends think my jokes are funny. And I said, well, the thing is, we thought they were funny when we first heard them, yeah. like 20 years ago. They're new to you and your friends, but yeah. we've already heard them. That's the only reason we're not laughing.
Yeah.
Just consider your crowd.
That's crazy that he confronted you.
Well, he was curious. He wasn't angry. He was actually he was more whiny.
Yeah. That sounds,
okay. How come you weren't laughing? That sounds like my friends think it's funny.
See, that's...
So I try to explain to him as diplomatically as possible. We've been on the planet for a while, so we've heard a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
So if you can take one joke and tell it, like, three different ways, then you have a larger comedic toolbox.
Yeah, I think there's something to, like, I think there's different levels of hack. Like, when I hear, like, people saying the same junk, like, just between, just regular people, passing jokes and similar points of view around, I get so like, oh, that's like regular person hack is the way I think of it. And that offends me almost more than like comedy hack, because it's just there's no originality out there. We're like, our thoughts aren't original. And that's terrifying, because I think that's why everything is awful. It's because everybody's having the same boring, Mexicans are taking the jobs anything about transgender people or calling Bruce Jenner, saying like Bruce Gender or Caitlyn Gender. It's like, you're the worst. You're just the worst, like, as a person. Like, everybody is just sharing their, like, groupthink garbage jokes and memes. Like, just everybody's passing around memes that, like, first of all, somebody did actually think of that at some point. They've been erased from it. So somebody else wants to be the deliverer of content.
Yes, get the credit for it.
Yeah, and now there's like this meme going viral, and the comic is eating SpaghettiOs and drinking PBR, and nobody should drink PBR. It's
no,
the
that's
worst.
Wrong.
It tastes like genetically modified corn. It's so bad. I don't know how this became about PBR.
Well, everything comes around, right?
Yeah.
It's cookie cutter mentality, and the only difference now, compared to 30 years ago, is that because of the internet, it just grows faster, that's all.
Yeah.
And speaking of growing, you've got Real Life Comedians.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I've been producing comedy shows for 5.5, maybe 6 years. And about a little over three years ago, I decided to keep calling them the same thing. So I don't have to get another logo, the flyer stays the same, the Facebook page is the same. So yeah, Real Life Comedians has been running for almost 3.5 years in San Francisco, and coming up on a year in Sacramento pretty soon too.
Cool.
Yeah. Last night actually in San Francisco, it was, we oversold the show. So the room legally holds 49 people and we had 63 tickets sold. So it's always a good thing when you're breaking fire code. we killed last night. Like we
literally
pulled
killed
the fire alarm and
literally.
Nobody could get out.
So do you have a sign off to your routines? Some comedians do when they leave the stage. Or is it just good night, everybody?
I will. Sometimes I try to say something really, really nice because I've been so dark and depressing. Or I will jokingly rip into the audience or talk about, get angry in a funny way. When I first started out, it was just awful. But now it's I figured out how to make people know that I'm joking. Because you'd think people would know. Because you're on a, you know, you're at a comedy club on a comedy stage telling comedy jokes. You think people would know you're joking, but they don't. They don't get it. You have to like give all the regular like human like verbal linguistic cues and smile and like do the nod and the
hold up a little flashcard that says joke.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's. It would be too easy if you could just...
Well, they're not supposed to think. That's your job. That's what they're paying you to.
That's true. So, yeah, I'll sometimes end with something like, hey, you guys are great. I love you guys. You're great people. And I mean it. You know, it's the stuff that I said, like when I tore into them unnecessarily. That's the stuff I didn't mean. But I'm usually not that mean to them. Usually it's towards myself.
No mean memes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Boom.
I recently attended an evening at a local comedy spot, offering a lineup of comics, two of whom were veterans. If you know a veteran who is facing challenges, comedy may provide a healthy outlet. By the way, the name of Jason's puppy is The Feminist Agenda. Do something different. Introduce a young person to some classic comedy, like Abbott and Costello's Who's On First. It's on YouTube.